We got about 2 minutes before. And John usually is don't ride out of work, so he's usually a little late, so.
So this is a good time for me to say that I'm in the Putman meeting room, which is one of the regular meeting rooms in the Lyle Shields, or next to the Lyle Shields room at Brookins. And I'm here to help us be fully compliant with the revised Open Meeting Act provisions.
Okay.
There, I said it.
You got it out of the way.
Got it out of the way.
But you're not in an empty building, right?
There might be people around.
That worries me.
You know, the doors are locked. When it's time for public participation, I will go out and look to see if anyone has come to do that. That is per our attorney's advice. It worked last time, so that's what I'm going to do this time.
Okay.
Interesting. And then we have to do all that.
Yeah. Different times. Strange new law.
Yes.
Three, four, five. Yeah, we have a quorum now, right?
Five, yes. That's what I was counting also. I was just going through and just see who's here. Susan's here.
Oh, so you have five.
And Julian's here also.
Julian, yeah.
Hello.
Hey, Susan. It's been a while. How are you?
No, I'm sorry. I've missed so much. It's not like me.
It's okay. We just like to see and have your probing questions.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Okay.
Nice to see everybody.
Good seeing you.
See you.
So,
Tom is also joining right now.
Okay, cool. So technically, is this Tom's last meeting?
It is.
We should have a cake.
Yeah.
I know.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good. So, let's call to order. Stephanie, could you do the roll call, please?
Susan Fowler.
Here.
Tom Moore.
Here.
Elaine Plencia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson. Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Jane Sprandel.
Here.
Jean-Paul Joachim. Joe Omo Salier.
Here. So, good evening. Is there anybody for citizen input or participation right now?
So I'm going to go, if you can give me just a minute, I'll go in the parking lot and see if anyone's here for that.
Okay. Just don't fall on the ice, okay? But is there anybody on Zoom who would like to have an input?
There's no one in the parking lot and there's no one in the hallway, and there's no one here in the room to give public input. There are a number of guests. So if you wouldn't mind, put your name and any agency affiliation into the chat area if you can. And then other than board members and staff of the board. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Good. So let's go ahead and approve the agenda.
I so move.
I'll second.
Thank you. So the comments are, it's cold outside. I could do it in a song, but I mean, it's just cold outside.
It is.
And it's been cold. The rest of my family's in Arizona right now. So they got some snow, but it's still pretty warm, much warmer than it is here. But yeah, everything is going well. I'm getting my second vaccine next Tuesday, so I'll be fully vaccinated, and I hope everybody does the same and gets the same soon. Okay. Lynn?
Big news. The big news is that we've interviewed a number of highly qualified candidates, and we are still in the decision process of finding a new associate director to replace Mark, who is retiring.
Good luck.
Mark is retiring on Friday. I know, Tom. Thank you. Thank you for all your thoughts and prayers. We have some really great options. I just want to say that. And the other big news is that on Friday at 4:30, the agencies completed the submission of applications for the next round of funding. And so I think all day Friday, some of us were hovering and watching and getting things ready. Then yesterday, we finalized the application list. So I think Stephanie emailed that to y'all yesterday, and it is posted with the board packet now as an addendum if anybody is interested. So where the board packet is, it's listed right underneath it. And we'll, of course, be including that in future board packets too. And while there's not a lot of action items for you all tonight, there's a lot of information. And I know that after this meeting, we're probably gonna pivot and really pay a lot of attention to those agency applications. So this is kind of the last of, well, actually you have a study session next week with a little more information, and then we'll get serious about the review of applications. So
we're always serious, aren't we?
We are.
Okay.
We'll be focusing more on that in the next, a month from now. All right.
Yes, we will. So moving on to new business. So we have Regional Planning Commission and Homeless Service System. And are you ready to present?
And they are here. Thomas and Lisa are both here, and you all should be able to share the screen, and also their materials are in the board packet. I could share the board packet on the screen if that's better, but you can share directly if you like.
Lynn, how is that? I'm on kind of a weird shaped monitor, so I can't share my whole screen without it kind of distorting.
No, that looks really good, looks really fine. Clear.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and start. Like you had said, my name is Thomas Bates. I'm the Continuum of Care Coordinator. That's the position that's funded through the Homeless Service System Coordination Grant. So I'm going to report on our progress so far in this year. So the Continuum of Care is also known as the Champaign County Continuum of Service Providers to the Homeless. The mission of the Continuum is to end homelessness in Champaign County. They're a coordinated network of resources for individuals and families who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. So the number one goal of our grant for this year was to grow the CSPH membership. Specifically, it was to grow the membership by 20%. So that's 6 agencies. So as of December 2020, we've added 5 new agencies. Those are Land of Lincoln Legal Aid, Champaign Park District, Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County, Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and the Center for Youth and Family Solutions. We also added Carl's Community Health Solutions, but those were just before our grant started, so we just missed that one. But I'm very sure that we'll be able to get another agency. Our second goal was to improve local, state, and federal resource knowledge. So as part of my day-to-day role, I attend a myriad of conference calls, webinars, trainings, things like that. So 11 conference calls so far, including this Continuum of Care discussion groups. And those are groups of continuums of care from across the state and sometimes across the nation who get together to troubleshoot problems, technical assistance providers, and advocacy organizations. So far, more than 10 webinars covering various new state and federal funds, primarily the Emergency Solutions Grants CARES Act application. That was a separate allocation of the Emergency Solutions Grant. It was, I think, one of the largest disbursements of funding for homeless services in history. So a lot of webinars and information around those funds. Training and in-person virtual conferences, including intensive HUD and Technical Assistance Collaborative, Technical Assistance for Housing Problem Solving, and the Supportive Housing Providers Association Fall Conference, and numerous HUD office hours on topics including the point in time, the ESG CV funds, CDC updates, vaccination planning, decompression of shelters, and a myriad of other topics as well. Our third goal has been data and resources to move towards an open homeless management information system. So right now we're in a closed HMIS system, which means each provider that operates in the HMIS, which is a computer system, they can only see their own data. We can't really have providers who see the whole system. So the idea behind moving to an open HMIS is that with all the providers able to see data, we'll always have the most up-to-date data, we'll be able to do much better coordination of care, things like that. We engaged in intensive housing problem solving technical assistance that wasn't directly focused on moving to an open HMIS, but the benefits for doing so were discussed quite frequently. There was, I think, one module specific to how to implement that inside of HMIS and kind of the benefits it can have. Several coordinated entry webinars. Coordinated entry is the actual mechanism for how folks get routed and connected to different services that are available to them that makes use of HMIS. So in other words, to improve our coordinated entry system, moving to an open HMIS is really something that we need to do. And to support that, we adopted a coordinated entry memorandum of understanding. And that MOU sets a foundation for a truly coordinated entry model, setting the stage for a transition to an open HMIS system. And one of the goals was for us to contact other continuums for TA on HMIS. That's fairly difficult right now. Continuums are generally at or over capacity in dealing with the deluge of COVID-19 funding. But some continuums, especially Lake County up north, have a wealth of knowledge on their HMIS systems available online, including a lot of training material. That's been very helpful, especially since they use the same specific software for HMIS that we use. Outreach and COVID response. So one of the things that we did early on in COVID-19, we coordinated the Illinois Department of Human Services Emergency Lodging Fund. The Regional Planning Commission actually administered those funds locally. It amounted to about $92,000. And those funds went to support CU at Home's Men's Emergency Shelter, Austin's Place, actually allowing for the extension of those shelters to keep operating past the seasonal end date. So that's back when they were still seasonal. We kind of unknowingly stumbled into launching year-round shelter, and those funds really facilitated that. And it also allowed for the expansion of the RPC emergency shelter for families. We've also been facilitating the shelter to housing work group. That work group has really been to link households that have been in emergency shelter with the housing authorities temporary C-19 preference. What that means is they have, for COVID-19, a temporary preference of, I think, 50 vouchers, to where they will give preference to people who we refer because they are literally homeless and have been in emergency shelters for, I think it's 14 days. That group is ongoing, that's been going on. I'm not exactly sure when that started, but I would say maybe June, something like that. We've also been coordinating the ESG CARES application and workshopping with first-time applicants to secure funds for Champaign County. That will hopefully amount to about $1.3 million between the two rounds of funding. The first round of funding was about $500,000. The second round has been estimated by the state to us to be about $700,000, but that second round of funding is not finalized yet. IDHS is still processing through, and hopefully we'll hear more about that soon. We do have a number of first-time grant applicants through the CARES Act application of the ESG program, and we had to provide significant technical assistance to get some of that done. ESG and IDHS are not necessarily the easiest grants to apply for, but I'm very hopeful that we'll see a more competitive traditional ESG process because of the work we've invested into making it easier for first-time applicants to apply to those funds. We've also had some hopefully successful advocacy to changes in the state consolidated plan to maximize ESG CARES funds. I might get a bit technical, but because we're a non-entitlement community, we have to obey what the state says we can and can't do with funds rather than what HUD says. There's something called homelessness prevention under ESG, which is essentially rent assistance. It's very restrictive the way that IDHS generally has it, and the advocacy that we've been doing will help us be more flexible with those funds and help more folks. That hasn't come to completion yet, but hopefully it will soon. We also had some what I would consider definitely successful advocacy for vaccine prioritization for the homeless system. You may have seen in the news recently, we were able to partner with CEPHD to organize some vaccination clinics inside of the Phoenix last week. And I think between the two clinics that were operated, we had about 30 folks vaccinated. We'll continue to advocate for more clinics. And I feel like as long as there is demand, we'll be able to work something out between us and the CUPHD. Briefly on the 2021 point in time homeless count. So the point in time is something that we're required to do every year. We go out and count everyone who is experiencing unsheltered homelessness. A lot of continuums across the country sought an exception from HUD to cancel their count. We proceeded with ours after receiving guidance from the COPHD and making sure everybody was wearing masks, and we were able to provide masks for anyone that we found. We had 25 volunteers, which is a very healthy turnout. I was planning for no less than 14. We had 25, which is only 5 short of what we had last year. So I consider that good. We completed 7 surveys, 4 interviews, 3 observation. We're currently deduplicating that, but in the end, it will look like an unsheltered count of 2 people. So a few folks there had stayed at CU at home the night before, so they are captured in the shelter count. And a few folks happen to be in situations that don't qualify as literally homeless. For example, if someone paid for their own hotel room, HUD does not consider that to be literally homeless, so we can't capture them in our count. We're hoping to have those results finalized, and hopefully we'll be able to share those in April. We have some historical data for the point in time from 2017 to 2020. This is in the packet, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about it. And this is some historical data for our housing inventory count. The same day that we do the point in time, we're also required to count all of the units of housing funded through COC and ESG, or through specific to homeless households. And this is what that count currently looks like. We talked about this a little bit last year in the update, specifically to explain the notable decline in transitional housing over the past couple of years. Basically, that reflects shifting priorities from HUD and other funders. This is the draft version of the housing inventory count this year. The most notable change from previous years is the inclusion of CU at Homes and Men's Emergency Shelter as year-round beds. We've always captured them, but now that they're year-round, they are really going to start impacting how many beds we have available. So that's good. And the same is true for CU at Austin's Place, which prior to this year was also seasonal. And I believe that is the extent of my presentation, unless there are questions.
I have a question just to understand. You said you wanted to increase the number of agencies in your program you had, and that was back toward the beginning. Yeah, and then you have that list of everybody who has beds, and I wasn't sure how those two slides related to each other. Are all of those people, all of those agencies that have the beds already in the count of your membership, or?
Yes, I'm pretty sure everyone on this list is an MOU member. Just a quick look, the answer is yes. Uh-huh. not everyone who is an MOU member also operates housing services. Some of them offer other supportive services like legal aid. Some are just good partners to have. So for us in Champaign Park District, we work with them to facilitate the point in time count. They let us use the Douglas Recreation Center to use as a staging area for our point in time count. And perhaps more notably, they work with See You at Home to kind of decompress the shelters and have more adequate spacing towards the start of the pandemic. Mm. So we're always looking for partners, whether they offer housing services or not. We're always trying to find different ways to partner with folks in innovative ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. This is Susan Fowler. I was surprised at the number two for unhoused. And I know it's point in time. What do you think the actual unhoused is?
I would not want to estimate that without doing some closer research. I think it's hard. It's hard to say.
Really?
I can say that I think on average at the Phoenix, which is a drop-in center, I think they tend to have about 40 or 50 people there a day. So when I'm talking about unsheltered here, I mean people who are not utilizing emergency shelter either. They're out literally on the street.
All night.
All night. So there may be folks who are doubled up who HUD does not consider to be literally homeless, so we really can't capture them here. And there are obviously folks in the emergency shelters. I think if you look at this last screen, you know, See What Home has capacity for 60 or 70 folks per night, just individual men. Austin's Place has a capacity of 14. So the point in time is not a hugely reliable way to count the unsheltered homeless, but it is what we're required to do. And that's the count that we have for this year.
Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand what it means to be a member of the organization. What does membership mean?
Membership means that you signed an MOU. So we have a memorandum of understanding that basically expresses certain facts. Both parties agree to those, the parties being the agency signing the MOU and the chair of the CSPH. And you know, membership can look like a lot of different things. It might be a supportive housing provider who has housing vouchers or has supportive services that provide services. Or it might be someone who does not necessarily have, you know, houses or physical beds, but they might provide some other service, or they might just be in support of the mission. And, you know, if something ever comes up that's in their wheelhouse, we can reach out to them and look at, you know, different ways to solve local problems.
So would I be correct then in assuming that theoretically almost any human service organization in the county could join and be a part of this consortium?
In general, yeah. Our governance charter has some more specific requirements. You know, you have to actually participate, you know, show up to the meetings. There's a certain number that you have to attend so many times a year and whatnot. But generally, yes.
I see. Okay. Are you continuing then? Do you have some longer term goal for, I mean, I could imagine thinking that every single human service organization in the county should eventually become a part of this network in some fashion. Would that be overreaching from your point of view? I'm not really sure.
I don't know that it will be overreaching. You know, I think it would be great if every provider who provides services, you know, to people is able to participate and agree to this mission. But ultimately, you know, we focus on what we can do right now. And if we continue to accrue members and we continue to do good things for the community and more folks are interested in helping us with that mission, we're always happy to make that happen.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I have one more question. And that is, it seemed like in the past we had more unhoused people or we had problems with running out of space. So would you say that the home men's, See You at Home Men's Emergency Shelter is able to take in all 60? Or is there ever a time when they're turning away people?
Well, I know Rob would want me to be very specific with how I answer that question.
Okay.
So first, I'll refer you to Rob Dollhouse and See You at Home to answer program-specific questions. But I know that they always repeat that if they, for some reason, cannot have someone there for whatever reason, they will work to find somewhere else for them.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I chime in real quick? Hi, this is Lisa Benson, Regional Planning Commission. Just to kind of piggyback on that question, Susan, this is another way that it's so important to have so many people be participating in the efforts that we do across the county. Through the continuum, we've been able to just garner so much more participation and collaboration. And so the ability to make sure that so many people, you know, if there was a capacity issue, people really coordinate and make sure that we don't have people that are willing to be sheltered, you know, housed or sheltered in an emergency way. There's been so much work over the last couple years, I mean, over many years, but the last couple of years, the collaboration and the partnerships have been monumental in making sure that we're creating a comprehensive system related to homelessness. Julian had asked about the membership and who could participate. You know, homelessness is so multifaceted, you know, so it's so important to have healthcare represented and public health and mental health and substance use and landlords and businesses, because it impacts so many different sectors. So we continue to grow and identify if there's areas where we don't have representation to garner that membership and to have a holistic model for the homeless services system. So I just wanted to add a little bit more to the questions that were asked. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Thank you, Alyssa. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bates.
Thank you.
So next we have First Followers.
Good evening, I'm James Kilgore from First Followers. Can I share my screen?
You should be able to.
Okay, can everyone see that? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, and My volume's okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm here to report out on our First Steps Community House, which is a transition house for people coming home from prison. We've been in operation a little over a year. So I'm going to give a little bit of background on it and then talk a little bit about what we've done and some of the challenges we've faced. Maybe just to start off, our mission is to build strong and peaceful communities by providing support, guidance, and hope to formerly incarcerated people and their loved ones through peer mentorship. So we're a peer mentor organization. That is, the leadership of our organization and the members of our organization are people, for the most part, who have been incarcerated or who have been directly impacted by having a loved one incarcerated. So we began in 2015 with a drop-in center at Bethel AME Church. And we weren't exactly sure where this was going to lead. We knew those of us who had been come home from prison fairly recently knew that there were no services for people or very few services for people coming home from prison at that time. So we opened a drop-in center and wanted to figure out what we could do to address that issue. So after about a year of running that drop-in center, we realized that the majority of the people that were coming there had two needs, employment and housing. And at that point, there wasn't really transitional housing for men in the community. And we felt that it wasn't a need that was really recognized in the community. So we believed that we had to create the awareness of the lack of transitional housing for people. So what we did is we engaged in a participatory action research project where we trained our peer mentors in doing surveys, kind of field work, sort of research. And we went to events that were predominantly catering to the Black community in Champaign-Urbana, since that's the majority of people coming home from prison and the majority of people who are incarcerated in this county. So we were quite surprised when we asked the question, are the housing needs of formerly incarcerated people in our county being met? Most people said no, they weren't, and the majority of the people that we talked to had either been incarcerated themselves or had a loved one incarcerated. But what really surprised us was that more than 80% of those surveyed believed that authorities should provide housing for people returning to the community from prison. So this put us in the position where we began to use our research to sell the idea, to promote the idea of a transition house in Champaign County. And after we completed the research, we did a sort of modeling, a discussion of what we wanted our transition house to look like, how it would operate. And we found that in our ranks, we had people that had also worked and or lived in transition houses. And those were people that we targeted to actually work in the house. And that was Cassandra Hunt, who was a case manager who formerly worked at the Prairie Center, and Charles Davidson, who later became a community navigator. That's basically someone who kind of orients people who are in the house to what's going on in the community, tries to help get them to job interviews, et cetera, et cetera. So we were fortunate enough to strike up a partnership with the Housing Authority of Champaign County, largely at the initiative of David Northern, the former executive director there, who had experience of having his own father incarcerated during his youth. So he understood the need for us to create this house. So the Housing Authority gave us a house to use rent-free to house people coming home. But we had to fix it up. It was in a bit of a shambles. It wasn't terrible, but it needed a good amount of work. So we brought in our own crew, the GOMAD, those from our emerging adults program, which is funded by the Mental Health Board. And they basically, as you can see, they painted, they did some drywall, they put in new doors, they redid the floor. That's a new floor there on the in the living room, and that's part of the team there that did that work. We also had a couple work days where people from the community came in and basically prepared the house for people to come in. So they did a thorough cleaning, made up the beds, put shelf paper on the shelves, et cetera, put all the equipment away, dishes and silverware and the like. We also did fundraising. So we did a number of fundraising events in the community, largely but not exclusively in faith-based community. So on the left there, you see a fundraising dinner that was organized by the Catholic Social Justice group at St. Patrick's, where we came, a number of us came and we shared a meal with folks there and explained our project to them. On the right, you see Church Women United. We went and spoke to them, talked about our project. So that ended up raising a fair amount of funding for us in terms of trying to get our house underway. We had the official launch in February of 2020 with David Northern and Carol Ammons and other people. And we had an event over at the at Papadel's Pizza with about 50 people from the 50 people from the community. At the same time, by this moment, we actually had a resident in the house. So as we were preparing the house, as we were doing fundraising, we were also reaching out to people in the prison system to get them to apply to live in our house. We set up phone calls with people. We reached out to counselors in a couple of the prisons, and we were able to get extended phone conversations, extended phone interviews with people that were in the prison. And we began connecting with Kewaunee, which is a kind of a reentry transition prison in IDOC, one of two. And we recruited Ken Norton, who had been in prison for 25 years, and he became our first resident. So here you see James Tiger Corbin talking at our launch. He is the person who's really been the driving force behind our drop-in center. So this is what the rooms look like. And most of the material in here was donated. We had a mother of a formerly incarcerated individual who made these very Illinois curtains. We also had people from the local churches donated bedding. We had Slumberland donated the actual beds and some furniture, and so that was that went a long way toward furnishing the rooms. So this is our first resident, which is Ken. Now Ken, as it turns out, is a graphic artist, and so in the run up to the elections, he designed some banners reminding people that had felony convictions that they also had the right to vote. So we put these up in, this is in front of the Cunningham Township. We also had one in front of the Urbana Post Office. We had one at the Mennonite Church as well. So this is, so basically we were able to provide some employment for Ken to do this art for First Followers, as well as help him secure a part-time job in the community. The other person in the photo is one of our peer mentors, Rodney Gross, who did more than four decades in IDOC. Unfortunately, he wasn't eligible to be in our house, but we've provided a lot of support with him. So I want to talk a little bit about what our program was like in our dreams, in our plans, and what it became under COVID. Because as you can see, we did a lot of outreach, we had a lot of support, and we had plans really to make our transition house into really a community hub. We wanted it to be a place where we could have educational events, where we could show films, where we could have dinners, and we could bring people in from the community to meet the people that were in the house as a way to give people who are in the house an introduction to different people in the community. Now, that didn't happen. Because of the COVID, we had to put in place some fairly severe COVID restrictions in the house. And so we really didn't have guests coming in and out of the house. And our own residents were very limited in terms of where they could go. We also had to shut down our drop-in center, so we just did it online, so we couldn't have people meeting at Bethel AME, which previously had been our hub of activity. So it really threw a big damper on our program. We also had made arrangements to go and visit prisons and to talk to individuals and recruit them into the house. So all of that, you know, really came to operate on a much smaller scale than we envisioned. So in the course of the year, We've had five residents. Ken, our first resident, is still there. Our second resident stayed for about 3 months and he got married. So that's okay. That's good. That's he's happily, he's employed and he's married. So we don't have a specific program, a time-bound program. So we have people staying for as long as it takes them to find their feet. We have another person who's been there now for 7 months, who is now going to be our first person to have to exercise the option of getting a housing voucher, because the housing authority had given us access to vouchers for our residents. If they completed a program, they could apply to the housing authority to get a voucher. So we're actually going tomorrow for the orientation meeting for him to get his housing voucher realized. So at the moment, we've just done a big outreach again for more residents. We've connected up with the statewide reentry network. We've connected up with all of our former, all of the network of people that we have inside the prisons. We've also done two mailings to everyone who's been on probation in Champaign County in the last 2 years. So we're actively trying to get a cycle of people coming through our program. So I think we've put a lot of energy into providing support for the people that have been there. We've had regular meetings with people, both using Zoom and having in-person meetings where possible. Our community navigator has provided a lot of transportation, a lot of counseling, a lot of advice for people, taking them to job interviews, taking them to get COVID testing, taking them to the food pantries, wherever they need, making sure that everyone there has access to medical care, has access to food, has access to employment opportunities and so forth. We've had a number of occasions where we've had to provide a lot of psychological support for people in terms of them dealing with various things that have been happening with them and their families and so forth. So we've been very active, not as active as we would like to have been, but we've learned a lot about how to deal with some of the issues that people have, how to address some of the COVID situations. And I think we're very well placed now to, you know, to grow our body of residents and be able to put in place a more complete program closer to what we envisioned at the outset. So this is just a list of all the various organizations that have supported us in this year. And you'll see there's one very big one there in the middle. Okay, so I mean, and I must say that, you know, the Mental Health Board has been our original source, our first funding source. So what you've done has been very important to us in terms of funding the staffing and the work in the transition house and in our GOMAD program and the drop-in center as well. So that's what I have to say. I'm happy to entertain comments and questions from people.
Yes, I have a question, Elaine Palencia. Your focus has been quite rightly men returning from prison. Is there a need for, do you have the numbers for women returning from the system here in this community that they would ever need this kind of support?
So the initiative the partnership that we made with the Housing Authority was a partnership where one house went to a women's reentry program, which is WIN Recovery, and one house went to First Followers. So yes, there is that. So if you look here on this slide, mm-hmm. This here is First Followers House. You can see the arrow there. Mm-hmm. This here is WIN Recovery House.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll say two things. there's always a need for people for getting housing, coming home. But it is, but in terms of sheer numbers, about 88% of the people coming home are men. We certainly would like to have a house for women in the future. But most of our clients were men. But we definitely want to address that. And we've also been working on addressing some of the needs that many women family members of incarcerated people have in terms of addressing both what happens to families when a male member of the family goes away to prison, what happens when that male family member comes home, how do we provide support for those people as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So quick question, Mrs. Joe from Mental Health Board. I was wondering, so you're talking about support. I mean, how before the release, what kind of support is provided for the family? Do you have any support groups or conversations or counseling for the family prior to the person coming home?
We have had conversations with two of the families before they came home. Mm-hmm. Before the individual came home, and in fact, one of the family members was pretty essential to leveraging the space for one of our residents. We've also had meetings with the family. So, for example, Ken, our first resident, his family is, well, there he has family all over the place. He has family in Mississippi, family in Chicago, family in Missouri. So we've actually met with his whole family and had various phone conversations. They came to Champaign and we sat down with them and talked to them about the program and so forth. We would certainly like to do more of that. That is also something that we would like to do through the counselors in the prisons. But I mean, because not only have we been blocked from visiting, but family members have been blocked from visiting people in prison. So the whole dynamic has been, kind of problematic in terms of trying to set up those kinds of communications. But.
Okay, thank you.
I also had a question. I know you mentioned that you were going to the prisons to recruit people to live in the house. What does that application process look like? Or was there a list of requirements that they have to reach to live in that house?
There's a written application where we basically kind of get a little bit of background on the person. I think what we're looking for is motivation to change. And the evidence of that is, at least to some extent, to what extent has the person been involved in doing programs while incarcerated that indicate that they're trying to make a change? Now, I realize that access to programs is problematic. It's different in different prisons. But when we have people that are in prison for a number of years and there's no evidence that they've actually done any kind of education or job training, that's kind of an indicator to us that there might be an issue. I would say that we are biased toward people who have spent a longer time in prison. I think both the data and our own experience is that people who have spent a longer time in prison tend to be a little less likely to get caught up and go and back in the cycle in repeating their own, their patterns of the past. We don't discriminate on the basis of what someone's offense was. We believe that a person is not what they did in the past, but they are who they are today. But the problem is that because this is a house that's under the authority of HUD, we can't accept someone who's on the lifetime sex offender registry.
Thank you.
The other thing is that we do phone interviews with people. Our model was to go and visit people and actually sit down and get to know them before they came, but we haven't been able to do that. But we've done phone interviews with everybody that's come out.
James, this is Tom Moore. Do you have any idea of the kind of impact you guys are having on recidivism, or you don't have that information available at this point?
Well, I mean, our numbers are pretty small. I mean, none of the people that have been in our house have gone back to prison, but that's a very small sample, number one. And number two, it hasn't been that long. So usually if you're measuring recidivism, you might look at someone being rearrested within 3 or 5 years. So we're not really in a position to make a judgment on that at this stage. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Mr. Kilgore. I had just some other questions. For the individuals that you do house, in what ways do you help them find employment so that they can transition out of the prison system?
We've been running our drop-in center for 5 years, so we have a pretty good handle on, you know, where there are employment opportunities for people that, you know, with like a felony convictions and a background like that. At the same time, some people come with a skill set, and then we can help them try to connect up with that. But I mean, we spend a lot of time. We have laptops in the house. We spend a lot of time, you know, working with people, helping them do online applications and so forth. I mean, quite a number of people, struggle with technology. If they've been incarcerated for a number of years, you know, they come out and, you know, wanting to get the newspaper so they can get the want ads to look for employment. And that's not always that helpful. So we work with them to build their computer skills, but we'll do the things for them. So we spend a lot of time, you know, sitting with people for a couple of hours, going through job opportunities. We partner with other organizations that, particularly like Salvation Army, has a lot of connections on these issues. We have good relationships with the temporary agencies. You know, it's not ideal for people to get temporary employment, but it's a foot in the door. It lays a foundation and gets a culture of work going. So we have a lot of relationships with employers through the 5 years that we've been doing this, I think the mentality of employers has changed a lot with regard to people that are coming home. Yeah.
That's great to hear. I also had another question on families. So what if, I know you focus more on people that have been in the prison system longer, but say you did have someone who had like a child and a partner, is that something that you look at to take a whole family in so they can be together as a whole family unit to help them transition home? Or is that something that you guys aren't focusing on or looking at specifically?
Yeah, we're not really in a position to do that at the moment. Obviously that would be a great thing. I mean, we need a whole set of different kinds of accommodations for different people's needs coming out of prison. And obviously it would be much, in many instances, it would be much, much more preferable for somebody to be able to go and stay with their family than to stay in a single sex house like what we have. But we're just not able to accommodate that where we are.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. Thank you.
I see in the chat, Daria, would you like to ask that question that you wrote? Oh, okay. So the question is the community house LGBTQ friendly? The Op Center has gotten requests for help from incarcerated trans folks specifically.
Sure, absolutely. We don't discriminate on any grounds except for people who are on this lifetime sex offender registry.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Well, if there are no other questions or comments, thank you, Mr. Kilgore. That was very informative. Thanks for sharing it and this.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
So, as we move along, we have the application list. I mean, I don't know how many of you have taken a look at it, but it's in our it's not in our packet right now, but it was on the email from Stephanie yesterday. And here it is.
It's posted on the site right underneath the packet as addendum. And you're going to see it over and over again.
Yes.
But this is the draft. Mark prepared this for us. He included all of the DD applications as well, including those that are funded by the DDB. So this is everything.
Everything.
Yeah. So I've gone through and created a smaller spreadsheet of only those which would, you know, so he also included, there are several that have 2-year funding, so you don't have to review the application. You've already made the commitment to extend the funding for 1 more year. And those are included in this list as well. So the big news is that there are 30 applications to review that are mental health board applications. So I have the list and, you know, I've already started looking at them. We just can't wait. So some of the staff were kind of hovering on the day, on Friday, when these were being submitted. And I'm already putting the program summary templates together, you know, and doing like just a light amount of analysis to get an idea of what we're in for the next couple of months. So you do have... I don't know if it's helpful to even to look at it on the screen like this, but you know, mostly showing it for the public and then referencing it is on the website with the board packet.
Lynn, this is Susan. I was wondering how many were new applications that we haven't had before.
Oh gosh, I think 2.
2, okay. And what's the funding request total compared to what we have available?
I don't know what we have available. I don't even know. So that's a really great question. And it's the first question that's on my mind. And it's absolutely the last thing that I'm able to answer with any confidence. Because just for example, in 2020, we budgeted a certain amount of money. We adjusted it a few times during 2020 because of surprises. And even then, there was a big surprise at the end of the year when we learned that a lot of people decided not to pay their taxes. And there's nothing we can do about that. So we have always had about a 99.5% collection rate for this fund. And this year it's 2020 it was 97%. So Chris completed all of our work for fiscal year 2020. Now the auditor's office is reviewing it and they will come up with, so Kayla has put a note into the chat, but Kayla, one of those agencies did not submit any applications. There are only 2 new ones. So thank you for reviewing the form. So anyway, we don't know what 2020 looked like. If it sent us into the hole, like that's a problem. But I think, you know, if we need to go and ask to take money out of fund balance to balance it, this is normal for these wild times. And then for 2021, we know what the projection was last year, but now I'm going to need to get some advice from the county on how to interpret that projection, knowing that, you know, we have the surprise of lower collection and what they might be anticipating. So I can't tell you what is available. I can only tell you what the total is. And the total requested of the mental health board, well, the total of all requests is $9,127,844. And that's for both boards. So could they're not separated out in this document. I have a whole bunch of other versions of this where I probably did separate it out. So we'll get closer to knowing something. So I guess we, it leaves us with the task of evaluating the applications purely on their merit without any consideration of affordability. That's kind of how we've approached it in the last few years anyway, but it is, 30 is more than we were looking at last year. And of the ones that are applying for continuation of a current contract, there might be some adjustments, but we may be able to take some and say, these are exactly the same as what you're funding right now. And then if you want to make those lower priority for the board review, that maybe that would help to organize the work. So anyway, so okay. I'll share with you the memo that's sort of a discussion starter for that, if you're ready.
Hey, go ahead.
That's not it. Where is it?
Oh, technology.
Yeah, this is so, it's so fun, but yet, here we go. This is it. And you've seen this before. We just update it every year. And I think the part that is usually on my mind is the timeline. And the timeline is, again, like it's a hope. Sometimes we have to add meetings to get this done or change the order of things. But the goal is to be able to focus on contracts in June so that people can start getting paid on July 1st or as close as possible.
Yep.
And then this is a template that Dr. Fowler created for y'all a few years ago, and I just updated it with a couple of, I think I got the changes in this year. Although it is only one page, it's still really high level evaluation. Like I don't think this is a 15 minute
over. No, no change necessary in my book.
Okay.
Any questions from board members or community? Okay, so we've done the review. I mean, just a brief discussion of the review already, so we're good there. Calendar? All right.
I think we've got the 2-1-1 data.
Mm-hmm.
So that's shared with us by United Way. They get it from PATH, which is the 2-1-1 provider. And I like the first page is really easy to follow, but then when you're looking at the data, it sometimes doesn't really have all the headers, that like all the subtitles that explain what it's about. So on page 19, there's a really big number next to rent assistance. And I think that what this means is this is the percentage change over this same period last year, but we just don't have the explanation on the headings. So, and the reason that I think that is that someone closer to this work talked about that while mental health costs have not stayed a great deal higher than normal to 2-1-1, calls for housing supports and other resources have stayed very high during COVID. So,
yeah. I think if you have calls for housing support, there's going to be some mental health issues that are attached to it because it's very stressful.
Yes, that's right.
I think that's something that we need to start talking about because this past year, there's going to be a lingering mental health issue connected to this past year. It's something that maybe next year when we're looking at the packets, we'll be talking a little bit more about how we're going to get things done.
Mental health. Well, Joe, congratulations, because this is the year when we do a community needs assessment and a whole new strategic plan.
Okay. I jumped the gun, huh?
No, you didn't. That's exactly what we will be talking about and thinking about as soon as we get done with the important business of what to fund next. That's going to be the project for the summer, really, to talk about what our approach ought to be if we are post-COVID, which, fingers crossed that we will be, but right. I don't think that's too far ahead. That's coming right around the corner.
Yes, it is. So, agency updates for COVID, on COVID response, briefing memoranda, page 24 to 36.
All of the content is just taken directly from the reports that the agencies submitted at the end of the second quarter. They submitted all kinds of other information, but these are the comments that are directly related to COVID that they pointed us to. Just, it seems important to kind of memorialize what we're moving through and really some of the great efforts that organizations are making to continue services under these circumstances. So there's, for some, there's a lot of information, for some, not so much because they've been able to make the adjustments already.
Lynn, what I noticed the most, this is Susan, is that agencies continue to try very hard to provide the services, but COVID has limited their ability to reach out to as many people as they might have. And it's an unfortunate side effect of COVID that people aren't able to go face-to-face or be in seminar or learning situations. And they have other issues that are impacting their response to services. So I think when I look at some of the reports, I think, I don't want to judge the agency by the low response rate because it's just such a difficult time. Mm-hmm. And clearly they're continuing to push and try.
Yes. Thank you for that comment. I think that's right. Like I'm just repeating what they've offered us. It may be well to ask them again, not to worry about putting it in the report so much as having a more full discussion of what they're going through. But again, they're still going through it. So maybe it's not time yet. Mm-hmm. We've got this, might as well share it. A lot of work went into it on their part. Thank you.
Yes, they have.
Ready for the next one?
Yeah.
So during the January meetings, we brought you and the Developmental Disabilities Board some similar questions about what to do about our SILA project. And the DD board wanted some information as soon as possible, and I didn't think it was possible. By the end of the day, there was a whole bunch of information because the Regional Planning Commission, Independent Service Coordination, and our associate director for DD, which is Kim Bowdry, she's on here, just were having the dialogue. She asked the right questions. They gave her a bunch of really good information about the unmet needs, about preferences. Then we filled in some of it with like what we're learning are the barriers to small group home capacity in this community, not very different from 2014 when we started the project. So this is really just an update. We put some possible next steps in here. And then after we put this memo together, I contacted the organization that's that does our SILAs right now, and asked if there was a chance, given this pretty big unmet need and a lot of people about to get SILA awards, if they might be able to put more people into the project and stay. You know, their staffing problem is not solved. We might have to find ways to help. They're not the only agency having this staffing problem. This is, you know, a very big issue in Champaign County, but it's also true across the state. There's this nice attachment here. The state, once again, paid a consulting firm to study its rates so that the firm could turn around and say, well, your rates are not high enough to support the kind of service you've committed to. So here's a one page, a really nice one page, hopefully in really clear language, of the recommendations from that rate study. And then today the governor's budget included a $70 million. Kim is on the call and she covered this for me, so I may be misquoting. It's maybe $70 million or maybe more than that. And she can bust in and correct me if I got it wrong, to implement recommendations. So I noticed it doesn't say the recommendations or all of the recommendations. So my concern is that 2 or 3 years ago, the state said to put our rates anywhere near what we think they should be would be like a $300 million increase in appropriations. So if it's really $70 million more, then I don't think they're going to be fully implementing these recommendations, and our community-based living system will continue to be greatly underfunded, and we might still have the staffing problem. But the good news is that we are going to have a conversation with the group home provider about putting some more people into those houses and trying again. So fingers crossed that's happening this week.
Okay, thank you. Is there no change on the calendar? I mean, no agency information? Are any of the agencies ready to give any kind of information? Okay, so it seems as if that's a no. We talked about the SILA already. And yeah, any more information on the SILA or schedules for allocation? Anything else you want to add? Or okay. CCDDB information.
Well, they met this morning and their business is roughly similar to this business, including that memo. And and guess what? They asked us to get some more information and bring it next month. So we'll be bringing it to you as well.
Okay. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. But otherwise, they have also, I think it's maybe 18 or 20 applications for funding from agencies. So they're on the same schedule that you are with that.
Okay, great. So, the move to approve the minutes from January 20th and January 27th. We could do them together, can't we? We don't have to do it separately. Approval of minutes for both sessions.
We'll move.
Thank you. I second. All in favor? Oh, that's not my part.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a roll call.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Elaine Plencia?
Yes.
Julian Rappaport?
His mic is off.
Julian?
You're muted.
Yes, yes.
Jane Sprandel?
Yes.
John Paul Joachim?
Yes.
Susan Fowler?
Abstain.
Tom Moore?
Yes.
Wayne Plencia?
Yes. I thought you already said.
Joe Omosage.
Yes. Okay. Staff reports. So Mark's report is there, and Friday's his last day. Yeah, that's the same thing I'm saying.
It is.
Yeah.
I did like his happy trails.
He should have done it and sung. Anyone see anything you would like some more questions on or answers?
I actually have one. If I could, but it's the DD board, so it would be Deb. I was curious when I looked at the PUNS data. There are 27 new people added to the PUNS, and I guess there's 356 that are on the list. It looks like, if I can read straight across the line, I'm not sure if it was deemed ineligible was 8 or 2. And I'm just curious, how many people from the PUNS list typically are deemed not eligible? That seemed like a large number.
You know, if Kim, can you do it?
Kim, I'm sorry. I said Deb. I meant Kim.
Yeah, I can do it. I don't have a specific answer. This is a document pulled off of the state's website, but this would be... that would probably be an annual number.
Okay.
So, I don't think that's just from.
It's from not the Champaign County. It's statewide. Okay.
No, this is for Champaign County, but it's not just from 1 month to the next.
It's a full year.
Yeah. Annualized. Okay.
Okay.
And it, the number of people that are deemed ineligible, I mean, that, to be honest, that probably seems low to me. But yeah, the state, you know, eligibility requirements are pretty tough. And I know that the ISC works with people to appeal decisions if people are found ineligible. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's not from 1 month to the next.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. And no other comments on staff reports, in board to board reports. Anybody visit any boards?
Yes, I don't know if anyone else tuned into the Community Coalition latest meeting, but there were two really nice presentations from a group of young men, the Goal Getters, about their prospects for going to college and their future. And they were charming and contradicting each other. And then there was another presentation from the Well Experience of Young Women. I don't know if it was out of the storytelling that Chandra's involved with per se, but they were looking at empowerment, language that empowers, language that's destructive. And they did it was a very nicely structured little presentation. So both of those, I was glad to see both of those.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Can I say something, Joe?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to just note that I put a sample of the CLC plans reports just as a follow-up from our conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to say I hope it was sufficient. Based on the feedback, I think it was adequate sample.
Yeah, it was useful. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks, Chandra. If there is nothing else, you just take an expenditure list as provided.
Do you want me to put that on the screen before you vote on it?
Sure.
Because I'm so excited that I know how to do this. And it'll be sideways, so it won't really be that helpful, but.
Well, we do have it here, huh?
You, yeah.
In our book.
You all have it.
But she wants to share her screen.
I just want to put something sideways on the screen and scroll through it really fast.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at it sideways though.
I've been here a long time.
Yeah. 12 hours is a long time.
I move to approve.
I'll second it.
Okay.
Do we have to take a vote because it's money?
Julian Rappaport?
Yes.
Jane Sprandl?
Yes.
John Paul Joachim?
Yes.
Susan Fowler?
Yes.
Tom Moore?
Yes.
Elaine Palencia?
Yes.
Joe Omosagie?
Yes. Any board announcements?
Can I just maybe nudge one by announcing that we have two retirements from the Mental Health Board. One was Kathleen Worth Couch, retired a month or so ago. And then also Dr. Moore is retiring after
I
today.
I know.
Just thought I'd bring that up one more
just
time.
Just one more time. So let's talk about Tom.
We can't let Tom retire.
No. No. You bring so much wisdom to this thing here.
I'm sure that in June, when COVID is over and the sun is out and it's warmer and the reviews have all been done, I won't know what to do on this third Wednesday of following the first Monday of every month. Now I'm sure there'll be some yearning. I'll miss seeing you folks.
Yeah. Yes, we will. We'll definitely be missed.
You're on a great trajectory. You got a good board. You got a great director. You're serving the community extremely well with the few dollars that you get. I think this is a healthy operation, probably the best one in the county for that, and the county administration for that matter. So, and I have to say that I have enjoyed and not enjoyed all the time that I've been on board. It goes up and down, but it's been a great experience, and one that I certainly would recommend anyone that's looking to do a community service.
Thank you.
I was younger when I started this.
Nicole says thank you for your service to the community.
Thanks, Nicole.
Lynn, will there be an effort to replace before the usual start date, or?
Yes, I think so. I can't, you know, that's very much out of my hands, but I think there okay. will be.
Is that up to the county board chair?
It's up to the county executive with the approval from the county board. So it's, you know, two big steps. Yeah. And you can be a 7-person board. So if you ever say, we just want to stop here and be a 7-person board, it takes you would have to have a formal action to that. But I think this board has been so good as a 9-person board. I don't know. I would be surprised if you'd want to let go of that.
Yeah, so. I'd need more people to read that stuff.
That exactly.
We need more people to read it.
Makes it
less.
30 proposals divided by 9 versus 7. Yes. Times 2.
So if you have a mind to send me a note about what you'd like to review this year, because I think last year it was pretty clear that the randomization is kind of getting old. You know, just kind of end up with the same things every year. So let me know what your preference is, and Joe and I will work on that for next year.
You could outsource it, you know.
So where are we going to send it to, man? So.
Someone who's retiring who might want
to. Oh, okay. Yes. It's all outsourced to Tom. Hey, it's been good to have you on the board, and it's good to have worked with you. I've known you for all these years, but the last few years working with you on the board has been great. Thank you very much for all the
thank impact. You very much. Thank you.
It's so hard. Okay. Let's see. Somebody move to adjourn.
Oh.
Okay, Tom. Go ahead.
I'll second.
Okay, we adjourned.
All right. Bye.
Stay warm and safe, everyone.
That's about all we can do. You take care. Have a good night.
That's all we can do.
Yes. Take care.